All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, joined as always by my friend and cohort, Mr. Mike Termont. Mike, how are you doing today?
Doing really well. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And even though you and I have our differences, today we're going to talk about getting rid of some really important differences in the United States.
Right. And for those that are accustomed to typically listening to Liberty Lens, and we thank all of you for watching. Mike, our fans, our viewers are used to us diving into one issue. Usually it's very nerdy. It's economics-based or politics-based. But today, let's talk about something that is a little bit more meta, a little more ethereal, perhaps. And that's something that's been bothering both of us, and we've kind of alluded to it, which is the polarization of America. This whole thing that the people that we find disagreeable are disagreeable to us because they're evil, because they're out to do no good. And therefore, they must be eliminated like some enemy. You hear a lot of this militaristic talk. So, Mike, I'm not going to get into specifics, but I want you to talk about it because I know you're passionate about this issue. So I'm going to just turn it over to you. Tell me, what is the cause? How did we get to this polarization in America?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Yeah, let's talk about that. And before I do, let me just throw out two quick thoughts. One is that it's not normal. You know, this is not the way it used to be. When I was growing up, even when you were growing up, if I can draw a subtle distinction between those two, me having had a slight head start on you, this is not the way it was. And I think It's important for people who are younger than we are to sort of internalize that. And some level, I got to say, you know, unless you want to do a tremendous amount of reading of history, trust me, this is not the way that it used to be. The other thing that I'd like to say about it is that there are tangible issues, tangible implications, ramifications of this, namely that our government is doing dumb things and not addressing important things, whether in a dumb way or not, just not doing it, because of what we're talking about today, because of the polarization. So I don't want people to think it's merely something that upsets us. It does upset us, and it's probably why the reason you and I are talking about it, because we're pissed off. But there are more important things at stake than just Mike and John being pissed off.
Right.
I think, you know, people say all the time that, you know, a good crisis will bring the country together. And if you were to go back to World War II, coming out of World War II, if you were to look at the 40s, the 1950s, you didn't see this. There was, of course, you know, coming into the late 1930s, there were arguments about whether or not we should be in the war, of course. And there were political differences coming out of the war. I don't mean to say that it was completely homogenous and everyone loved everyone, but it was not like this. In fact, one could be forgiven for forgetting that Dwight Eisenhower did become a Republican, right? It was not something that was in your face. He played a lot of golf. He didn't piss people off. I don't think he was what you would call an Austrian economist, but he did leave people alone, and it was a go-go economic era. And then you come into, you know, the 1960s, right? 1960, President Kennedy, President Johnson, instituting what Johnson characterized as the Great Society, right? Programs that were reminiscent in terms of their sweeping change and interventionism of FDR's programs. So this was a big deal. But it would be a mischaracterization to say 1968 or 72 or 76 were huge backlashes against that. That's not really the case. There was plenty of consternation and arguments about it. Not everyone was on board, that's for sure. Right. My grandparents were very anti-Kennedy Republicans. But it wasn't this huge swing of the pendulum because we hated the other side. And then you had the expansion of the Vietnam War, which was the first time that you had a great deal of politicization of people's emotions and big swings. But even that was not seen as merely a Republican-Democrat thing. People were mad at Nixon for the way he handled the bombings, and people were mad at Johnson for the expansion. So it was an opportunity for all Americans to hate their government. As a libertarian, that doesn't bother me. Coming into, you know, you had 76, which was more Carter was more a backlash against Nixon being a criminal than it was an anti-war stance, right?
Right.
And you didn't really have a backlash against the 60s Great Society of Programs until you had Ronald Reagan elected in 1980. And that was the first time that language was used like Reagan revolution. It was the first time you had what people would have characterized as a really big political, cultural, social pendulum swing, a backlash. And that lasted 12 years. But in 1992, when Clinton was elected, it was not seen as a big backlash against conservatism. Clinton was not the most liberal Democrat one could choose, that's for sure. It was an exhaustion of the American people with Republicans, which is a natural political phenomenon. We get tired of one party eventually. 12 years is a long time, and there were economic issues, and President Bush, for whom I worked on his campaign, so I think I can say this and own it, he was not very good at it, and our campaign was not very good at getting his message out. It was natural that Clinton would win. It was not a big backlash. In 2000, I don't think you could characterize George W. Bush as being a big backlash against the Democrats. The big criticism against W. these days, from our perspective, is that he wasn't conservative enough. He was conservative, but, you know, Clinton and W. did not get elected saying mean things about anybody. So, brings us to Barack Obama. And when Obama was elected in 2008, it was relatively progressive. One might perceive that as a little bit of a pendulum swing, a little bit of a reactionary type of election, a little bit more than what we had seen before. By today's standards, not terribly dramatic.
Right.
This is why so many people say that a real turning point in this polarization of the nation was the second Obama administration. How he had changed his mind a little bit about how he's going to handle certain issues. Immigration, Obamacare. Getting a little bit away from what we would have characterized as the traditional view of adherence to the Constitution and what the appropriate role was of the government and of the executive branch. In Obama's case regarding immigration, it was getting away from what he himself had said 3 years earlier about what his powers were to handle immigration under the Constitution. And whatever you say about Barack Obama, you cannot say this is not a smart guy who understood the Constitution. He was a University of Chicago constitutional law professor. He knew what he was doing and just made some decisions. And so as much as people would like to characterize 2016's election of President Trump as the big moment, I think it's important to recognize that there was a little bit of Reagan contribution to this based on the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson's contribution, and Barack Obama's contribution to this.
Right.
And then it's off to the races, right? When we were growing up, you did not have a politician saying bad things about Americans.
Well, yeah. And I mean, let me just touch and jump a little bit in here. You've largely described the political sort of wins as basically since World War II, but you've been describing them in terms of the presidency, which is fair, right? Because I think, to use your phrase, when we were kids, when we were growing up, certainly the president was the most visible beacon of policy. But what you had underneath it in Congress was also a little more subtle than it is today. For example, people forget Democrats controlled the House basically uninterrupted for 40, 45 years since, like, say, 1960 all the way till Newt Gingrich. A lot of these policy decisions and the way the country was able to remain relatively unpolarized, if that's a word, depolarized to be a good scientist.
Unified, together.
Because you did have an underlying Congress that, although adversarial at times with the presidential administration, still found common ground and did not characterize the other as evil as opposed to wrong.
I think that's a great point, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, because it highlights a couple of different things. Number one, we have seen a movement toward what many people have called the imperial presidency, the White House gaining so much power. And it's a simplistic way of describing politics,
right?
No question about it, when we just talk about the White House, but you do miss so much. The other thing that it highlights is that there used to be a very different relationship, not based just on power, but on politics,
right?
When Reagan and Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, a Democrat, well-known, powerful Democrat, right? And an Irish Catholic from Boston, when those two guys allowed the world to see that they were buddies, it was not manipulative, right? They did have some respect for each other.
Right.
And yet it did not cost them points. It wasn't like, oh, we better hide this.
Or we need to primary the other. I think that's like to tie it to today, right? Because famously, and this is when I was like, say, a teenager and starting to become more politically aware, famously, you had Reagan say, Tip and I'll get a beer and we'll talk this out, right? The famous "we'll talk this out over a beer" comment.
That's where it comes from.
And Tip O'Neill famously saying, I don't agree with the president, but we got to give him a chance to put his programs in place.
Yeah.
So the two of them acknowledged, hey, there's a reason one's a Democrat and the other one's a Republican.
There was no hiding it. And neither one said, oh, you know, I feel wishy-washy today.
Right. And neither one, however, came down to the level of saying the other one's evil, the other one's out to destroy America. Certainly you had your little back and forth, you know, Reagan with his folksy jokes and Tip O'Neill with, you know, like the, we got to appealing to the unions and whatnot who were anti-Reagan,
right?
But I think you had that sort of understanding, especially as a citizen watching your leaders in Washington, that there's differences, there's partisanship. But at the end of the day, neither side is trying to destroy, quote unquote, America, which is what you hear a lot of today. And also societally, Mike, because I want to kind of lead you into this. You and I used to have an old adage. The two things you never discuss at the dinner table are religion and politics, right? And now it seems that's all people want to talk about. It dictates the invitation list to that dinner. So you could see, and we don't even need to go back to World War II, Mike. Just going back, say, to the Reagan administration, which I happen to agree with you, that's probably when you began to see the swing slightly. But if you had to go back in time, 1980 seems to be that point where this polarization began, right?
Right. With a nod to Johnson as having set up what it was that it was a reaction to.
Absolutely. The famous line by Hubert Humphrey, if this Civil Rights Act is used to set up quotas, I will eat this entire legislation on the House floor, to which William Buckley every year sent him a copy of the legislation, salt and pepper, and a napkin and some cutlery so he could enjoy his
meal. It is what it is.
It is what it is, but those were political, right? I still would argue that those did not represent visceral hatred of the other side.
Yep.
So given that we were not at that point, say, 40 years ago.
Yep. Why are we now?
Why did we get here? What contributed to this, Mike?
I think a couple of different things. The two big ones, to your point about not talking about politics and religion, and now it's all that we talk about. One is the downfall of certain institutions in our lives that created a vacuum that public policy discussion and government more generally have filled.
Right.
The church. The church was a unifying force. And I use church in the most global, in the most Catholic lowercase c sense, essence. It was something that was unifying in the sense that it was off limits, and the presumption was everyone had one, right? Like, you know, you don't talk about your private parts in polite company. That doesn't mean you don't got private parts. It means we don't talk about it, right?
Right.
We
right.
all have a certain amount of humanity. It binds us together. That doesn't mean we need to discuss the details. It just means we have a tremendous amount in common. And people were passionate about their faith, their religion, the institutions that the churches that represented these feelings, these emotionally charged, passionate feelings. And that has in no small part gone away, but the human propensity to be involved in something greater than ourselves, to adopt passionate stances toward those institutions, that's as human today as it ever was. The other institution that has fallen is the family. We might as well be honest. I'm not trying to necessarily sound like a 1990s Republican, but you cannot hide the fact that the divorce rate is up, that people move all over the United States, and their involvement with their narrowly defined, traditionally defined family is not what it used to be. Well, these are powerful forces. These are demographic-sized upheavals in our social fabric, and they have created vacuums that have been filled by a variety of things. The pursuit of wealth, sure. We live in a very, very wealthy country, and the pursuit of our health, and a lot of people would interject that we've become a more selfish society. I don't have data to back that up. That may or may not be true, but people have asserted it. And the rise of passion for public policy has filled in no small part these vacuums. And then number two, if I can characterize that as number one force, right?
Right.
And we can talk about why these institutions have fallen, but that's a different podcast, right?
Right.
Let's just leave it at that, that certain institutions no longer have the roles that they used to. Number two, the technological changes that we have gone through that have allowed for initially the bifurcation and then the fractionalization of our media. It used to be, kids ask your parents, that you got your news from CBS, ABC, NBC, and everybody got their news from the same sources. They did not play off against each other. One's a Republican, one's a Democrat. There weren't enough of them, and the market was big. So they had to appeal to everybody. So you couldn't say bad things about one side or another. You would go out of business. It was just that's the way it was. And so with the advent of cable news, CNN, there was this ability to have many more channels. Imagine if social media is bifurcation and stratification and fractionalization on steroids. It had to start somewhere. And where that started was with cable news. The reaction to CNN by Fox, the reaction to Fox by MSNBC, and so on and so on and so on. And it gave people the opportunity to watch news programs, or what at least were ostensibly news programs,
right,
and get a set of opinions and eventually a set of facts that would make you feel good about yourself so that you would continue watching. That was a business model that made sense. Still is a business model that makes sense.
Right.
And as we know today from social media, what I don't think we fully understood then as a matter of ubiquitous science from experimenting over and over again, nasty messaging gets clicks.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
It just does. So if you were Fox and you were maybe a little bit unkind to Democrats, right, you would be rewarded by your base. You would get more viewership. And it was a two-way street. You know, Fox would indicate and demonstrate its loyalty to one side, to its audience, and the audience would reward that with its loyalty. And let's be honest, just as a matter of biology, we are a tribal species. Yes. You know, we do seek out our cliques and our cults and our families and our groups and our parties and our nations.
Homophily, as William. William learned a new word, and he likes using it a lot. Homophily, yes, yes, absolutely, yes.
That is just the way that we are. And these new institutions, these new news organizations were able to leverage that and make themselves a tremendous amount of money. And that rolled right into social media, which gave everyone the opportunity not only to collect news and opinions that made them feel good about their own opinions, but gave them the ability to view people that were so loyal to their viewpoint that they would just say horrible things about the opposition as a demonstration of that loyalty, that adherence to tribalistic culture.
Virtue signaling is what you're basically...
Virtue signaling. Yeah. And this has accelerated. And this has become intertwined with public policy for any number of reasons. Yeah. So you see the technological revolution of the media. And by the way, that's not a completely new phenomenon. It's new from the technological angle. But if you were to go back 100 years, it was not uncommon for newspapers to be well positioned within either the Republican sphere or the right. Democratic sphere. It was just, you know, the way that it was. And for most of the 19th century, you know, we would have two or three newspapers in New York, and we had, of course, two newspapers in Chicago when I was growing up. And if you were a Republican, you read the Tribune, and if you were a Democrat, you read the Sun-Times. So
absolutely,
it's not like this is a completely new phenomenon, but yeah. It wasn't until people were really able to lean into, through these new technologies, this idea that who was feeding you the information was so tribalistic that it created this bubble, this echo chamber, that meant clickbait was out there with really horrible things being said by the other side.
Right.
And I think that for a lot of us, a turning point was when this became intertwined with politics, so that all of a sudden, a real turning point for me personally, I'm sure others of your viewers will have different turning points in mind, but when Hillary Clinton characterized, what'd she say, a third? I can't remember the math anymore. Something like a third of all of the people supporting Donald Trump are in this, what I would call, basket of deplorables.
Right.
Wow. A dozen years earlier, that would have been political malpractice. Nobody sure. would be dumb enough. First of all, I don't think most people would be dumb enough to think such a thing. But certainly no one would be dumb enough to say something out loud about American voters, right?
Yeah. And Mike, I just want to jump in here for a second, because as I'm listening to you describe, I think very accurately, what has happened, there's been these sort of thoughts and popping into my head. So let me back up a little bit. So to your thing, the crumbling of institutions, whether it's the church, and by church, by the way, like you said, any sort of community force. I saw a documentary that described society went to hell when we stopped bowling. Like that, some sociologist right. did some research, because everybody in the 50s used to get together at the bowling alley. It was a communal thing, right? But you get the point.
All kinds of communal institutions.
Right.
The moose and the elk have not done well.
Right. The Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, all that stuff, right? But I would argue that that force has never disappeared. That vacuum still exists. It's just that we found something else to provide it to us. So one of the criticisms of the Soviet Union from the West was the reason they got rid of the church under the Soviet Union, or tried to as much as possible, was because the absence of the church would force the people to fill that vacuum that you're describing, that a lot of people describe as the God gene that we all have.
Right.
The state filled that vacuum. So now it was the party that became, in essence, your church.
Right.
And now you have generations of Soviets. You had generations of Soviets that viewed the state with the same reverence that they viewed the church.
Yep.
So in our situation, I align with you with saying, like, even if you're an atheist, if you're an agnostic, or any flavor of any religion, the crumbling of that institution has left a void. Who's filled it? The nanny state, for one, as we clearly see.
Huge
with our spending. The other one is the tribalistic piece that feeds into that, which is your faction. And yes, you did mention cable news. I would go a little bit further back to the Paul Harveys, to the Rush Limbaughs on radio.
Absolutely.
And particularly effective with conservatives at the time.
Yep. And still are.
And still are. To this day, you really don't have the equivalent of Sean Hannity or Clay Travis on the left, which is another interesting sort of dynamic that I love.
It is. There are those who would argue that that's because NPR is getting so much money from the government that it services the left-hand side sufficiently.
Right. Absolutely, yeah. So you're starting to see that, and to me it's a little bit of a interesting thing, right? So it started with those guys. Why? Because the disaffected, at the time those guys became big, were the conservatives, because they felt that every other form of gatekeeping media was against them, which is true to some extent, right? Like the major news networks, right? So I agree with you there. And at the time, people who studied these sort of things always said negative news travels wider and faster as a contagion than positive news. Hey, Mike is screwing around on his wife. That'll go 8 times faster than Mike just cured cancer. That is human nature, right? So that is – when you combine all of that and then you throw social media, which I don't think caused the divide but obviously accelerated it. Because
Absolutely.
Now –
it played its role in accelerating it.
What do those algorithms do? By design, they show you stuff that you interact with. So if you're a kind-hearted person but tribalistic –
what makes you feel good.
Right. So you see the stuff that reinforces your point of view, bubble number one. If you're an outraged person that can't wait to rail at the universe, that means you're interacting with stuff that gets you angry enough to respond to it. So therefore, what does the algorithm do? Well, he's interacting with the stuff that drives him crazy. Let's send him more of that stuff.
Let's drive him completely bonkers.
Now you get more intensity.
Yep.
So to your point, we're at this stage now where everybody that doesn't agree with us is evil. Everyone who doesn't agree with us is out to get us, both metaphorically and physically.
Yep.
How much
it does foster a little paranoia.
It does foster the paranoia. What role does education play in this, in your opinion? By education, I don't mean getting a degree necessarily, but I mean the ability to say, okay, hold on a second. I am just seeing all this social media that tells me that lizard people have infiltrated the White House, are running a sex shop out of a pizzeria, and, I don't know, the Russians are going to come get us within 2 days.
Yeah.
Right? So what part does education play, or the lack of it, to say, wait a second, can I take 2 weeks to figure out what I'm consuming here and at least make an attempt to ascertain the probability of its accuracy? Because I think that also plays into it, right? The willingness of people to be more, ironically, more convinced than they were, say, in the 50s and 60s when you did have this gatekeeping media that you only had the one opinion on TV.
No, you're absolutely onto something. I'm not optimistic that's going to be a solution for us. I think that education, our ability to educate ourselves, our ability to use tools to educate ourselves, AI is going to play an interesting role going forward. We'll see whether that is a silver bullet that helps get us through this.
Or kills us, coup de grace type of thing.
You never know.
Right.
But there are reasons, I think, to be pessimistic about that, not the least of which is who's got time, right? Mm-hmm. And our natural inclination is to be lazy. To go back to the analogy of faith and religion, and not just the analogy, not just metaphorically speaking, but right. to go back to the existence of those institutions playing a bigger role in our lives, people were involved with their churches without spending oodles of hours contemplating whether their pastor were telling them the truth or not. There was a comfort in being able to trust the pastor, to have faith in your faith, to have faith in your religion, to have faith in your God. There is a comfort there that precludes an interest in pursuing educational endeavors to figure out whether what you're taking as a matter of faith is true right. or not, right? You know, as a Lutheran, yeah, I went through my phase of reading everything I could about the first century AD, but most people don't do that. I did it as a matter of curiosity. But if your faith is contingent upon such educational exploration, that's not faith, right? So I'm not optimistic that we're going to be able to educate our way out of this. I'm hoping I'm wrong because I think it's an extremely powerful force. And now with AI, I could be dead wrong. It may come to a point, and maybe the way to look at this is eventually our ability to collect information will become so granular that now we don't have to rely on any institution whatsoever. Every individual will have an ability to tap into all kinds of information. Maybe right. that'll be the upside of living in a surveillance world, that there'll be so much information collected from so many different sources that you'll be able to tap into an artificial intelligence machine that's able to sort through this and actually tell you what's happening in the world. That would be fascinating. I'm not optimistic that's going to happen anytime soon.
Right.
And so you've got this situation where politicians, the media, and now corporations, which I think is arguably the weirdest of the three spheres of American society, are going out of their way to feed into this machine, these echo chambers, even to the point of saying something negative about the other side. And that's a weird place to be. One of the things that I fear that we have spoken about briefly in the past is our economy will become as split as our media has become, as our politicians have become. I'm optimistic it won't get that bad, but we're certainly on a path to a place that isn't better than where we are now. We're on a path to a place that's worse.
Right.
And it didn't start with Budweiser. It didn't start with Nike and Kaepernick. It started earlier than that. I recognize that, but it has certainly accelerated lately. I would offer one. Let me just throw out this one example.
Sure.
There was a little bit of pressure on Michael Jordan. Again, you know, kids, ask your parents. There was a little bit of pressure on Michael Jordan. You got to get involved. You got to make a political statement once in a while. You've got to support this. You got to support that. And he very famously said, Republicans buy shoes too.
Right.
In other words, right. you know, leave me alone. I play basketball. My side gig is making billions off of shoes. It's not politics, right? That would have been his side gig. And he wasn't willing to go that far. Whereas the pressure on LeBron James, who, by the way, is not the ball player that Michael Jordan was. I thought I would just throw that out there in case we weren't being divisive enough.
I would expect no less from a good son of Chicago, but yes.
Thank you. The pressure on him was too much for him to resist.
Right.
The expectation these days is that you get involved. And he didn't do that good a job, objectively speaking. I think he would not argue with me on this point. He didn't do a great job of it with regard to China, with regard to 2020. I think that he would like a couple of do-overs, which is not to say he completely screwed it up. He obviously didn't bring down his empire. I don't want to exaggerate. But the point is, it's a minefield. There are plenty of reasons why, objectively speaking, if all you care about is profitability, lots of arguments to stay out of this, and yet the pressure on these leading athletes is so enormous that they just can't. And I would throw Taylor Swift in there as well.
Yeah.
Just can't, at the end of the day, can't resist.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because as you were talking, I did have the Michael Jordan example on mind. And by the way, he made that statement, I think, on David Letterman. So it was to a nationwide audience, right? Republicans.
Yeah, it wasn't hiding the ball.
Right. But it kind of falls back on two principles. The first one is, I'll give you an example, was when you and I were working for corporations in the 80s, a lot of people don't realize this, like big banks that you think might be inclined to contribute more to one side or the other, say to the Republicans because they were the money people, right? It's a lot of people don't realize this. Most big companies split their political donations right down the middle, 50-50.
Absolutely.
Now, right?
You did not want to get caught doing otherwise.
Right, because they understood we got to play nice with whoever's in power. It was very practical. Individuals in any company may have spoken out for one candidate or the other.
And the corporations were biased in favor of incumbents,
right,
but not biased in favor of one party or the other.
Right, and they put their money where their true beliefs were. Now that's not the case, obviously, right? Then the second thing is, the only place, the only business that I know that actively takes no stand in its business, I'm not talking about its owners or anything, is Amazon. Amazon is really the last place where you can go to, it seems to me, that everybody's political agenda is for sale, right? It was interesting because, just to sidetrack a little bit, the 86-47 controversy with Comey, right? It was, oh man, he knew, get him. I literally went to Amazon, typed in 86-46, and all these products relating to Biden showed up. They're still for sale on Amazon, folks. Not only does that show you that you had the 86-47 and the 86-46 up there, but it acted as a sort of research tool very quickly. When you had one side saying, we never did this to Biden, no, you did. We never profited. We're not making it up about Trump. Yes, you are. Here's other stuff. We were outraged then. No, you weren't. Here's right. So here's Amazon that is actually practicing what you are sort of mournfully saying has disappeared, which is their number one goal is profit. Their number one goal is we're here to make money. And if that means making everybody happy, that's what we're doing because that's how we make money, which ties into the old libertarian trope from various economists. If you trade with someone, you're less likely to become their enemy, right? It's you don't trade with your enemy voluntarily. You only trade where there's benefit for both of you. So I'll buy my pencils from a Democrat. I'll buy my milk from a Republican. Why? Because I want the pencils. I want the milk. I don't care what their politics are, right? People who are saying boycott so-and-so, if it's the best service or best product at the lowest price, I couldn't care less where it came from. Mike, how much does that play into everything? Meaning, why would corporations focus on half their addressable markets, to get technical with marketing, right? If you're only appealing to Trump fans, I understand there's a market there. I get it. There's a market there. But you're literally saying I'm writing off half this country, literally at this point.
I think that there's two reasons. One, you're dumb. And I think we underestimate the extent to which that happens sometimes.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, I mean, Coca-Cola is the company that introduced New Coke. That was not imposed on them by Marshall.
Right? Yes.
They made that decision on their own.
And they quickly regretted it, right?
Budweiser did make the marketing decision that they made that cost them I think they were down 20% of their right. corporate value at one point. They made that decision on their own. That was not imposed on them.
Right.
So let's not pretend that these corporate titans are, you know, uniformly economically sophisticated and they don't make mistakes. I think that I would be misleading if I didn't include that as one of the two big reasons why companies sure. do this, is they just make mistakes.
Right.
You know, they see these political trends, they analyze them incorrectly, and they stick a toe in the water. And that's the American way. You know, that is entrepreneurial, productive advancement through destruction, right?
Sure.
People make mistakes and they get their butt kicked and we move on. They
yeah.
learn.
You had to work Schumpeter.
Yeah. The other one is that people perceive that they need to fill a niche, right?
Right.
I don't think that Hobby Lobby necessarily tacked conservative because they wanted to bifurcate the market. They did a little bit. I think a lot of Democrats, you know, probably hung in there with them, but, you know, some Democrats didn't. But they did very well among Republicans. And so corporations are always making these calculations of depth versus spread, right? Extensive marketing versus intensive. If I'm getting $50 from 50 customers, am I better off or worse off if I can get $100 from 25 customers and then right. I lose another 25 customers? These are the kinds of calculations that they need to think through.
Right.
That doesn't even count the companies that have that as a specific strategy from the get-go. You've got Black Rifle Coffee. I don't think they're hiding the ball here. If they were unable to recruit any Democratic customers whatsoever, I don't think that really undermines their marketing right. strategy. And this is because it's an extremely competitive market. And so to break into such a market, you've either got to reinvent coffee in a way that no one had ever thought of, and that's probably not going to happen. Or you're going to market yourself in a new and creative way by intensively plumbing a particular market segment.
Right.
To your point, it would be exactly the wrong strategy for Amazon, which is a dominant player, which does not face competition from a whole lot of companies just like Amazon. That's right. not a thing, right?
Right.
So you have that problem. And I worry about this not being the case going forward. I worry about how many markets will get split with certain providers for Republicans and certain providers for Democrats, or maybe it's conservative versus liberal or big government versus small government, and that
right.
becoming an extremely inefficient way to run an economy.
And to that extent, I just want to focus it a little bit. When you say there's a market, there's a niche, yes, but the word niche means by definition it's small. It's not going to grow, right? Because you're appealing to and sometimes there's need for that, right? Like
yep.
there's a need to service, say, people who are unable to walk, right? Like whether it's with medical devices
yep.
or care. But that is not a market that, for obvious reasons, is not going to be expansive. It's going to be very limited to a very specific number of people.
Right.
What you and I are talking about would be the equivalent of an Amazon, would be the equivalent of a Walmart, or look, Target made some decisions that they regretted, right? Because they decided to jump on.
Right. No one is saying that they're super geniuses who never make mistakes.
Right. So when you mention you fear for the economy because it may fragment into these thousands and tens of thousands of niches. I'm assuming you're saying that's a bad thing, as opposed to – because, listen, as libertarians, we always say, what do we want to see? We would rather see 1,000 mom-and-pop stores as opposed to one mega store that's the same everywhere you go in every state, right? So for people that might be confused, why is Mike, the Austrian economist, so afraid of multiple niche businesses as compared to the mega corporations?
Because I fear is an uneconomic force imposed on the economy.
Ah, there you go. Talk about that.
This politicization, right? It's not a matter of who likes decaf and who likes very strong, highly caffeinated coffee. We're not talking about that. We're not even talking about marketing to people on the basis of certain individual characteristics that make sense, that do have cost implications. We're talking about a completely arbitrary and artificial imposition on the market of things that have nothing to do with coffee, have nothing to do with its consumption, with its distribution. And so you have plenty of markets where it's not completely competitive. You don't have 100 competitors. It's not dominated by one player. You have what we would call, it's called monopolistic competition. It's where you have individual firms trying to differentiate themselves. And on what basis? Well, if it's a product that is viewed as nearly a commodity, like coffee, there are plenty of examples. Not everything is such an example, but there are plenty of examples. You're going to try to differentiate yourself based on something. And to your point, niches are small, but if you define that as conservatives, it's smaller than the entire country, but it's not a tenth, right? It's still a lot of people. And by the way, the tenth of the United States is still a lot of people. Getting yourself down to, well, I only service 35 million people.
Right.
You know, one could imagine doing very well off of that. And so one could, in effect, manipulate, take advantage of people's quite human tribalistic character. In fact, I don't think it would be good for our society, but as an economist, I would completely understand if you were introducing a new bottled water to the supermarkets in this environment, I think it would make complete sense to take a shot at all kinds of different branding and marketing. You know, I got one for liberals. I got one, by the way, I would use a different brand. I wouldn't let anyone know it was the same company, right? I got one for liberals, one for conservatives. I got one for libertarians, one for Republicans, one for Democrats. I got one for the Green Party. I got one for tall people, one for short people. I got one for men, one for women. You get where I'm going.
Right.
If you're Hispanic, right? If you're white, if you're black, if you're Asian, you know, just put 40 of them out there and see what works. Maybe none of them, but I would not be surprised if there were certain niches that had some success. And look, President Trump understands this, right? The Trump brand, the MAGA brand, whatever you will say about it, he's not wrong about that ability to sell and sell more than just policies and politics. So we know that this is an issue. So I worry about people coming to these conclusions. I worry about them being right. I worry about certain of these strategies becoming successful and that reinforcing our tribalistic nature all the way down to potentially bifurcating geographically where we shop. I could imagine, right. You know, a mall for Republicans and a mall for Democrats. I could imagine at some point Amazon saying the wrong thing and the rise of another online mall that would eat their lunch. That's fine. That doesn't really bother me. A little competition would be a good, that's probably a bad example because that would make the world more efficient if Amazon had a true competitor. But there's plenty of examples where the supply chains could become bifurcated. And I'm not talking about just social media and media, but the corporate world in general, I think that would be a real shame.
It is. Yeah, I don't know that I have your doom over it, your sense of impending doom, because it may just be the natural evolution of marketing. It might just be the natural evolution of consumer behavior. So while I am like any old timer, this change is disturbing to me, right? Because it just is, right?
Right. But the extent to which it's necessarily bad has yet to be demonstrated.
I'll agree with you on that.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this to wrap up. How does Mike Termott potentially see us not falling into this sort of
How do we climb our way out of this?
Yeah, how do we escape this tribalism, this polarization? How do we get back to Reagan and Tip O'Neill? How do we get back to that sort of environment, politically, Market-wise?
And I don't know that you do shoot for that. I think you've got to shoot for Eisenhower. You got to shoot for going all the way back. And there's, as I see it, there's two different paths. One is full-on crisis. And we do have crises around the corner. We have the potential for war because of our militaristic, interventionist military policies the past generations.
Right.
Trump, to his credit, believes that those past policies are bad for us. But that doesn't mean that all of a sudden we changed our spots and all of a sudden the Pentagon is becoming a peace machine instead of a war machine. That seems like a bit of a stretch to me. I'll pray for it. I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
The other one, of course, is the debt crisis. That is that's on the rails and coming. And the other one is possibly even more related, which is, I fear, a civil rights crisis at some point. We've had riots. We've had riots for, you know, a millennia, but the riots seem to be getting worse and nastier. You got January 6th, but you got a whole lot of 2020 that we don't do a very good job of talking about.
Right.
And with increasing power in the hands of the White House, with what I would argue is increasing authoritarianism and a departure from the Constitution, beginning with the 2012 second Obama administration, one could easily imagine a heavy-handed response from the White House or from a governor to certain aspects of rioting and the underlying forces that cause rioting being more persistent. And so I could imagine a downward spiral being put in place that could be very, very damaging to our nation. And the fourth existential crisis I fear for our nation is AI, which we'll talk about someday. So there are real crises out there that could cause us to leave behind a lot of the silliness. One thing that characterizes the polarization is that we argue about increasingly petty things. We talk about dumber and dumber and dumber things.
Right.
You know, it's not like we didn't have problems in the 1950s, right? It's just that we didn't want to politicize certain things. Certain things were just not polite to talk about in public. I get it. Things have changed, and probably in a good way. I don't mean that we want to go back to the 1950s socially.
Right.
I don't want to force people to think that their own personal behaviors, being in the minority, are bad, or their ethnicity, their culture, their race, being in a minority means there's something bad about that. That's not what we're talking about. In that sense, we're in a much better place as a nation, as a culture, and as a society. But our government's role in it has become far too heavy-handed. And so getting back to a focus on what's important and differentiating between important things and unimportant things is a way to fix this. I would hate to rely on a crisis to fix this. So let's focus on a second path that might be slightly cheerier. And that is, I know this is going to sound wildly self-serving.
Okay.
But hear me out, as
sure.
The kids say. Hear
sure.
me out. I think that we need to get back toward a little bit more of a traditional, what I call American, libertarian view of the role of public policy. I heard over the past couple of days discussions. A lot of folks are watching this show with Abby Phillips on CNN because she has done a good job of trying to open up the conversation in a different way than it was precluded from doing so during the Biden administration, to call it what it is.
Right.
Okay, great. She got Republicans, she got Democrats. They're having arguments on, good for them for having arguments on there, but they're having arguments with a complete inability to sort out the difference between cultural issues and public policy issues. It's just all jumbled up. On the other side of the political spectrum, I know a lot of folks, Ben Shapiro's group, Daily Wire,
yeah.
They have done very well. They've been very, very popular. There are few analysts out there as good at analyzing the Supreme Court from a conservative point of view compared to Ben Shapiro. He's really a smart, smart guy. But his organization's inability to stop mixing up cultural issues and public policy issues is a problem. It's hard for a libertarian like me sometimes to even follow the conversation because it's so jumbled up in their heads. They get upset about something.
Right.
Well, what's the White House going to do about it? No, that's not the right question. I don't want to hear what your answer is.
Yeah, because I was thinking of that guy Walsh with the he's still with the Daily Wire, right? He seems to be the guy, like,
yes,
not
Matt
the,
Walsh. That's
Matt
right.
Matt Walsh. I don't mean to necessarily pick on him, but
he's a big boy. He can handle it.
Yeah, but what I mean is, like, you'll see him. He's all interested in what makes a woman a woman. And by the way, some of that film I laughed at. From a comedic perspective, it was funny. Right? But
he may well be onto something that's important socially and culturally.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I.
But to tie it into policy, as you said, some things are best left, like you said, to the libertarian mindset of government. That's not a government's business. If nobody's being hurt, if nobody's being – like, there's a difference between – now, I could hear some of my paleo critics or some of my paleo friends or LPNHs, whatever, saying, like, well, yeah, you know, like, but why can't we do that with the gays then, for example, right? And, like, we don't want them around us. We feel it destroys the family structure, whatever nonsense they have to say.
Well, and you do have a right to say that.
Absolutely. But the difference is that, what caused the Stonewall riots or whatever was, if you were gay, the police could roust you with no legal basis. Just because you were gay, and if you go back far enough to the 60s and the 50s, certainly before that, if you were black in the United States, you could get rousted without probable cause. You could get thrown in jail, beat up, lynched, whatever, to magnify it, right?
Yep.
There's a difference between what was going on then where you said, like, it's government needs to back off and be involved to the sense that people are being beat up, assaulted, murdered over their lifestyle choices, their belief structures. There's a difference between that point and the point where you're in now. I disagree with someone being gay, so let's pass legislation to have them not be gay or not be gay in public. So if you kind of look at a graph, you're at a low point when people were getting beat up by the government. You're at a low point now when you're asking government to change behavior. Let's get to the top of that distribution curve. That's like, as long as people are not harming anyone else, let them pursue their own self-interests without government getting involved, which honestly is the true libertarian position. And to that extent, Mike, I agree with you wholeheartedly. That might be our best way out, to stop relying on government to stop assaulting people. And
when I was a kid, I remember the Nazis marching in Skokie.
Oh, so do I. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. This was an important moment. Now, my parents were socially liberal. Right. My dad was a Republican. My mom was a Democrat, and they didn't argue about it. They, you know, I think they saw eye to eye in most things, but they were both quite socially liberal. This was not complicated in my household.
Right.
They were extremely clear with me. Like, we didn't even have to spend 1,000 words on it. You know, it was basically, yeah, you know, they're bad people. They have a right to march past the potatoes. It's just the way it was. And the fact that my parents didn't need to spend 1,000 words on it made it seem like what it was. This is just how it works in this country. And we need to get back to that because we've got a whole generation that thinks, well, then they shouldn't be allowed to march.
Right.
That's a problem.
That's a huge problem. And the other end of that, I would say, is also a problem. If it pisses off the other side, let's do it, no matter how ridiculous it is.
Well, and that's a social, cultural problem.
Right.
And to the extent to which there are people out there who want to fight that fight, right? And whether that's you know, people who are on CNN or the Matt Walshes of the world, right? Or others, have at it. A lot of you I'm going to agree with. Maybe I'll even send you a check, you know.
Right.
Stay out of public policy. And we're not picking on Matt because I think he – actually, I don't listen to him enough, so I really don't know. But it's my impression he stays out. You know, he's not advocating for, you know, the federal government to impose his views on people. He's a social, cultural warrior. That's fine. You know, whether I disagree or agree with him, that's fine. You know, knock yourself out. Do you, and you spread whatever message you want to spread. And the churches should spread their message. And the kids who hate this or hate that, go march. You know, do your thing. You know, but getting mad because the government won't do your thing, that's got to stop.
Yeah, petitioning government for your personal choices is always bad. Just to quote very quickly, I hate Illinois Nazis. That was from the Blues Brothers, of course, when they came across the bridge. I hate Illinois Nazis. But to close on my from my perspective, that was always the critical role that stand-up comics used to play. They used to take these outrage positions. Usually it was a leftist position because they were the ones who were always disaffected. The best stand-up comedians are the ones who had horrible, miserable lives.
Absolutely. And pushing the edge. That's what progressivism, you know, that's a good part of progressivism is that you're pushing in ways in which our culture needs to go, or at least we need to test whether or not we need to go.
Agreed. And it because it was always done in the context of comedy. Went to the nightclub. No one forced you to go there. You listened to it. If the comedy got through to you, great. If it didn't, great. But that's the context people took it in. And part of the reason I think that being a fan of comedy, we prevented the stand-ups from being able to do that. They either got canceled or from both angles, right? Like the conservatives kept saying, oh, these effing liberals, oh, why do they get the mic all the time? And then that migrated to the left.
Conservatism just isn't funny enough.
Yes, there's no funny conservatives, people used to say, right?
Like but definitionally. Not funny enough.
Nobody is a conservative who's upset with the status quo. That's part of what people don't understand. Conservative means you want to keep things the way they are for the most part because they work for you. And you're a progressive, you're a liberal, to use the coinage, if you're upset with what's going on around you. So stand-up comedians who would always used to rage at things used to be predominantly liberal because that's the environment they were raised in. So I think when conservatives got upset, like, why aren't there conservative comics? Because you guys have had good lives. Let's face it. You know, why.
It's totally – I grew up a conservative and I always have considered myself socially conservative. And so it's, you know, me and my family who's watching a comedian laughing and going, you know, was I allowed to laugh at that? Because, you know, it's funny and it holds up a mirror to, in so many cases, the dumb stuff that we hang on to is the status quo, you know, of which we need to let go.
All right. Mike, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think it's been a long time coming. I hope our audience enjoyed it as much as I did listening to you about this. All right. Until next time, when we do this again, this has been Big John alongside Mike Termott. We'll catch you next week on Liberty Lens.